really meaning is kind of plausibility. And what I mean by that is the kind of perceived likelihood of some proposition. And from this perspective, you could say that, you know, you can reason about the probability of something in the future, say it rains tomorrow. You could reason about the probability of something in the past, say, I don't know, Napoleon had this, I don't know, childhood experience or something, or something in the, you know, roughly present. I mean, you can reason about many different things, and it's not just, so to speak, dice and coins. So part of this is that your probability assignment for something is always fundamentally tied to some sort of state of knowledge. And you can't speak about the probability of something. It's always the probability of something with respect to this set of information. Come in. So a really good example that I like to give for this is if you have, say, a coin. And this is, you know, the prototypical example of probability theory. You know, you flip a coin, it lands on your hand, you cover it up. And if you kind of open up your hand, what's the probability that it's going to be heads? Almost anyone would say, well, it's, you know, a half. But if you had, say, taken a snapshot of that coin when it was in the air, and then a microsecond later take another snapshot, you could infer from that kind of the, the angular momentum is such, and the, you know, kind of center of mass momentum is such and whatnot, and work through with it and say with definiteness, well, the probability that will land on my hand heads up is 1 or 0. So really, probability is always tied to a state of knowledge. And you can say something like, well, you know, the probability of the coin landing heads up, but there's always kind of some inferred state of knowledge or context surrounding that probability. And you could ask also, well, you're talking about, say, the probability of some statement AI. What kind of statement can that be? I mean, a lot of them are, you know, experimental outcomes or, you know, possible happenings in the past. But I'm going to get to that a little bit later. And here C just kind of represents your entire state of knowledge. And in some cases, this can be enumerated very carefully and say, well, we have this strict data. And then we're going to reason based off that data. But in a lot of cases, it's somewhat more vague. And it's just kind of, you know, in day-to-day situations, say, the probability that it rains tomorrow. I mean, it's very, very hard to kind of list, you know, what exactly your data is. It's just kind of, I don't know, something you see and make a guess about. So in this sense, probability theory can be applied, you know, more strictly in some cases and less strictly in other cases. But the fundamental thing about this, or connected to the fundamental thing, is, again, that there are no pure probabilities and that everything is tied to some sort of state of knowledge. And you could also object that, well, in quantum mechanics, you know, isn't quantum mechanics inherently probabilistic? And, you know, couldn't we say that that is an objective probability? And I'm just going to say that that's a rather kind of murky area, and there's a lot of discussion related to that. So, yeah, quantum mechanics, it's kind of up in the air. But at the very least in the classical realm, it's pretty safe to say that every probability is just, you know, some sort of uncertainty. So getting back to it, if we had some statement, say AI, which represents maybe some sort of experimental outcome, something like that, what can AI be? And probability theory says that, strictly speaking, it has to be something that is true or false. And we're not going to get into like all the connotations and philosophical implications of true truth and true falsehood. But really just, you know, for most physicists, biologists, statisticians, whatever, what that means is simply that AI has to be something that you can unambiguously say, ah, this did happen or it didn't happen. And if it rains, say, then you have some sort of procedure for establishing that it did in fact rain or it didn't rain. And if it drizzles a little bit, then you could say, well, if we hold out a cup and collect all the water, then if the water line is a certain amount, then we say that it did rain. But there has to be some sort of cutoff line with this. And one can also take, or rather in sciences, one at least initially should take the cautious view that the only thing that we can really kind of truly reason about, the real kind of inputs to our system of reasoning, are things that we see and hear and things that are kind of directly relevant. And you can reason later on about things like, well, you know, this particle is here, or this momenta is here, or the scalar potential at this point is such. But really, those are kind of theoretical propositions. And somewhat obviously, you need to introduce a theory before you can reason about theoretical propositions, which is something that we're going to be getting back to more later. So kind of a justification for this, you know, statement of, or this policy of only reasoning about operational statements, is that really, if you're introducing a theory and then talking about the things in that theory as if they were, you know, some sort of real state of reality, you know, you always have to be prepared for the idea that, well, you know, those propositions could be negated, or it could be found that something like the particle is in this position is in some sense a meaningless statement. So everything eventually has to be kind of tied back to kind of what we see and hear and stuff like that. And an example of this would be, say, the theory of relativity, in which in the 19th century, people would have said that, well, reasoning about something like, you know, this event happened at time X, or time T naught, or something like that, would be a meaningful statement. But it turned out that once you introduce kind of operational definitions of stuff, that you get extra kind of behavior that you wouldn't expect. So strictly speaking, everything that you reason about should in some way be tied back to measurement outcomes, you know, bleeps of detectors and things like that. Oh yeah, and a good example, this is something that there's a guy named Edwin Thompson Janes, who I will probably be referring to here a few extra times. I'm just going to write his name here. He called something somewhat related to, but he referred to something somewhat related to this as kind of the mind projection fallacy, and assuming that these kind of theoretical entities, you know, are really kind of manifested here. And really, when you're talking about some sort of theory, you have to, you know, talk about, you have to understand that this is a theory and it's not necessarily representative of the real world and whatnot. Let's see. Okay. Now, if we are to introduce theory into this, how should we do this? And this is actually largely kind of inspired by, there were a few papers that Rob Speckens did in which he kind of refers to this setup, which we're going to describe in a bit, as an ontological model. And simply put, an ontological model, or kind of this sort of, theory setup, is a way of introducing new propositions that you can talk about. Because if you don't want to strictly be stuck with talking about bleeps of detectors and things like that, if you want to introduce something else, you have to introduce a theory which has that. And one of the requirements for that is that, and if you're some sort of experimental preparation is denoted by SI, say, and a measurement is denoted by uppercase M and different outcomes by lowercase m and labeled, your theoretical entities kind of provide a bridge of predicting different things about different measurements. And I've denoted those things by just Q. But one of the fundamental things that you need to have is that you need to have a means of linking all of this to the real world. Because if you're talking about theoretical entities without any means whatsoever of connecting them back to the real world, then you have a theory with no predictive power. So in the case of an ontological model, this would take the form of probabilities of different theoretical entities having different values, or kind of if you have an experimental setup, you could say, well, this setup is really in this particular state, labeled by Q1, Q2, et cetera. And you know, perhaps it might be the case that you don't know exactly what that state is, but you can predict different probabilities for that. And then given that, you can say, well, maybe it is in state Q1. And given that, you know, there will be a probability that you'll get some experimental outcome. And what you can do is you can, this is called the law of total probability, and just sum over all the different states that something could possibly be in, different theoretical states, and then kind of get your probabilistic outcomes. And you can compare this to really doing the experiment and kind of getting frequencies there. And also, an important thing that I didn't mention before is that Bayesian probability theory also encompasses the frequency definition of probability theory, and that you can talk about, well, I've done this experiment and I've done it 10 times and I've gotten these different outcomes. And assuming that your information about the different preparations was the same each time, then you can make statements about, well, if I perform some sort of measurement on a similarly prepared system, what is, you know, what do I think will happen the next time? And there's kind of an unambiguous way that you can do that. So in this sense, you can, you know, kind of create these theoretical entities and test out your predictions and then compare it to kind of the real world measurements. And in a sense, a lot of the sciences, and in particular physics, really, you know, everything you learn just is up here. And if you take a class on quantum mechanics, you know, most of the stuff that you're going to learn about is just wave functions and different, I don't know, projectors and things like that. But I mean, in reality, you know, science is kind of much broader than that. And if, especially if you're an experimentalist, you're going to have to deal with the fact that, you know, what you're actually doing in the real world is this sort of thing, and the theoretical entities just kind of come, you know, afterwards. And I mean, one of the, kind of obviously one of the really, really big benefits of this is convenience. You know, it allows you to predict quite a few different things and reason about a wide range of different propositions using the same set of theoretical tools. So convenience is a really big reason for introducing kind of theoretical entities like this. And just some examples of different theories that everyone is very likely very well acquainted with would be something like statistical mechanics. You know, your base theoretical entities are positions and momenta. And if you have some sort of small system, you could say that your, you know, experimental outcomes would be things related to macro variables, and talking about the pressure of some sort of system or the temperature, things like that. And based off of that, you can assign probabilities to these different things, which would be the, you know, possible position momenta that all the particles in the system could have. And in statistical mechanics, there's, you know, given some sort of pressure and temperature, you can kind of determine the different probabilities. And then given some experiment later on, you can predict what the outcomes are going to be. And in electricity and magnetism, at least classically, you know, your theoretical entities that you introduce are going to be the different values of the electromagnetic field at each point, and the charges and whatnot. Again, quantum mechanics, it gets murky, and there is a lot of discussion over, you know, can you even say that there are real entities in quantum mechanics? And one way of looking at it, in particular with mixed states, would be, well, we have this system, and its state is really described by a wave function. And we don't actually know what wave function it really is in, but we can kind of set these different wave functions with different probabilities. And then later, we have rules that, given it's in some wave function, what's the probability that we're going to measure it at position X, or with a certain momentum or energy or whatnot. But again, there's also a lot of murkiness related to quantum mechanics. And there are some people that say, well, actually, the real state of the system is the positions of the different particles and then the wave function on top of that. And that would be the Bohmian kind of interpretation of quantum mechanics. So there really isn't a lot of agreement. And some people say there really aren't any, you know, kind of ontological states, and there's different variations of that. So we're not going to talk a lot about quantum mechanics, because that is an entirely different, much harder discussion. Does anyone have any questions just related about the general Bayesian formalism? Because I went through it kind of quickly. Okay, cool. How much time? Oh, wow. I'm burning through this. Should slow down a little bit. Okay, so we're going to talk about the importance of kind of introducing your context into this. And in particular, it has been claimed by different people, and I think Feynman had some statement that he published that was essentially equivalent to this, saying, well, quantum mechanics tells us that probabilities don't behave the same in quantum mechanics as they do in classical statistical mechanics. And in particular, you know, you can look at something like, well, you know, you have a particle that's prepared in some definite momentum state, and it passes through here, and you could say, well, it either goes through one of the slits or the other, and then simply do a classical probability sum of it ending up here. So also, yeah, I should probably explain my notation. In this case, this xk means that this is some sort of more meaningful proposition. It means that we have some detector that's placed here. And it kind of, if there's some particle that ends up there, it, you know, there's a spot of light or something like that. So it's something we can see or hear or whatnot. But at the other time, this omega 1 and omega 2 are the statements of, well, the particle passes through here, or it passes through here. So there's kind of assumptions that are being made here which aren't necessarily stated when a lot of people talk about it, such as the particle goes through one slit or it goes through the other slit. So and this derivation right here is actually very, very simple to do. It's simply that if you say that the particle will end up there given some sort of preparation, and the fact that you are measuring, oh wow, I'm writing really big. And the fact that you're measuring the end there, you can say, you can do the law of total probability and sum over different j's. So this is the probability that given this preparation and the fact that it is measured, the position is measured at the end there, this is just the probability that it goes through one slit or it goes through the other. So already when we do this, we've introduced this theory. And the theory says these are theoretical propositions. We're saying that this is a meaningful statement, things like that. And just from symmetry, you can see that, you know, there's a probability of one half of it going through there, one half going through the other thing. So this is going to be one half, regardless of whether j is 1 or 2. So oh, I can move this up. So I mean, pretty simple. It's just saying, well, we don't know what slit it went through, so, and we don't have any reason to believe that it went through it was more likely to go through one slit than the other. So we're just going to average it. And there's a, you know, this is kind of the rigorous way of doing it, but it eventually does end up with that argument of, well, we have no information with which to distinguish the slits. So we just take them both with probability 1/2 and do our sum. But then you see that, well, this isn't actually the case, or a lot of people argue this, because if we cover up one of the holes, then, well, we know it went through, you know, slit one. And if we cover up the other hole, then we know it went through slit two. And yet when we have both of the holes open, it's not the average. It's something completely different. So the question is, have we violated probability theory? And the answer is no. Part of the reason for this is that you're not including all of the relevant information. In particular, quantum mechanics, one could say that the thing that quantum mechanics teaches us is that if you go back to this, you could say that the, most obvious interpretations would be that omega 1 and omega 2 aren't valid propositions, that it doesn't actually go through one of the slits or the other. And that, you know, this is just kind of an example of you introducing theoretical propositions that stop really making sense. But another thing that you could say is you could say, well, let us measure this. So if we were to change the setup so that we're now measuring which hole it goes through, then where was I going with this? Oh, yeah. So kind of what this is implying is that when you are doing something like this, what you're saying is that you are covering up one of the holes. And this information isn't being introduced into your relevant information. And in particular, you're saying that you could introduce some sort of extra thing, which you'd say would be so omega 1 represents covering up one of the holes, and in particular covering up hole 2, which means that we know with certainty that the particle kind of goes through hole 1. So then, so the thing is that the context in this case, kind of the relevant information in this case and these cases are different. And it doesn't have to be the case. I mean, if you're referring to different experimental setups, you don't necessarily have to, have kind of meaningful relationships between this experimental setup and this experimental setup. And if you were gathering data about, say, car accidents, and you didn't include the information of whether it was raining or not, of course you're going to get, you know, it was possible to get behavior that would seem somewhat paradoxical. So one could also argue that in quantum mechanics, this is saying that, if this is some omega, which means that both of the holes are open, that it doesn't necessarily have to be the case that this equals the average of these, because this and this and this all refer to different contexts, and they don't necessarily have to have any relationship to each other. So this gets to the point that probability theory is first and foremost a purely mathematical theory. And in fact, when Bayesian probability theory was being developed, or at least one of the really early people to write about it, Harold Jeffries, one of his statements that he made was that really probability theory should not have any kind of axioms in it that fundamentally relate to the real world. Say if you're talking about, some sort of physical system, some sort of experimental setup. Obviously, in the axioms of probability theory, you shouldn't have predictions made about that specific experimental setup, because otherwise, if you have no way of knowing that that behavior will necessarily be this case, and you kind of subject probability theory to being violated, much like any kind of physical theory. So in a sense, probability theory, it's just math. And it's like, someone saying we violated probability theory is like saying, well, we've proven that topology is wrong, or we've proven that linear algebra is wrong. You can't do that. And you could say in some cases, well, it's not really applicable here, which is kind of what's being done with quantum mechanics. But first and foremost, it's a mathematical theory. So you can't prove it wrong or anything like that. What else? Yeah. So those are just two different ways of explaining why our theory doesn't fit the experimental data. And now just the final thing, and this is somewhat unrelated to the rest of the talk, but it's also one of the things that I've been kind of doing some research on and thinking about, so I wanted to talk about it. Is even in the Bayesian literature, sometimes people leave out the fact that if you have some sort of conditional probability, that this has to have a physical representation, that you can't speak of some kind of super observer who's standing outside of the world and looking in. What really needs to happen is that if you want to have a realistic model for any observer, you say that it has to, the information that it has to be represented physically. And this actually relates a lot to Landauer's principle. Landauer's principle is something in computing that says that if you have some sort of irreversible logical operation, then that logical operation necessarily generates entropy. And this actually is related a lot to Maxwell's daemon. I'm going to explain that a bit. I'm going to use this board. So Maxwell's daemon, the original formulation of it was that you have a chamber, and it's separated by a partition. And in one half of the chamber, you have some gas, and the other half you have another gas. In the partition you have the daemon, and the daemon measures, and after measuring it kind of allows a gas molecule to pass or not pass. And the argument went that this daemon would allow the entropy to decrease by having all the hot gas on, or all the hot molecules on one side and all the cold ones on the other, or rather the ones with high momentum and low momentum. And there's actually a much simpler kind of clarification of this experiment done later by, I don't know how to pronounce his name, I think it's Leo Gillard, is that? Okay. And it was just done with one gas molecule. And you're saying that there is this molecule kind of moving around, or atom, or some sort of entity. And you can kind of break it into two propositions, that it is in this half of the cylinder, or it is in this half of the cylinder. And you have some sort of daemon, which I'm going to draw by a squiggly thing here, denote by a D. And what the daemon does is it first puts a partition here, and then it measures it. And I don't know how to represent. It's by some, microscope thing, kind of shines light. And it gives the daemon information. And based off of that information, The daemon can say definitely, well, it is either in here or in here, and accordingly, insert some sort of piston in here, and then, you know, moves the piston up, releases the partition, can extract energy from that. So what you have with that is you have some sort of, you know, gas, in a loose term, that is, you know, initially kind of an unknown state and has a higher entropy, and then this daemon is, you know, taking that gas and getting work out of it, which is a violation of the second law of thermodynamics. And the thing was, back before computers were created, and when Maxwell originally created this idea of Maxwell's daemon, which it is named after him, he didn't really think of the idea that, well, this daemon is obtaining information, this information has to be stored in its brain or whatever. It was just, well, it's an intelligent entity, and of course, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to store it anywhere. It's just kind of sentience or whatever. So kind of the reanalysis of this that, I don't know, at least the way that I think of it now, which I think clarifies it a lot, is you have some statement that either, so if you have a system like this that has a certain entropy, we can say it's, again, just a one atom gas. You can have some sort of mechanical method of, you know, something you could say put on this that somehow would just reduce the entropy. And it either is or isn't the case that, you know, this is possible, because the second law of thermodynamics is a thermodynamical kind of postulate and was motivated by empirical observations. So it's still an open question of whether it can or cannot be violated. Because there's no kind of underlying motivation for it besides the empirical stuff. So, let's see. So the original way that people had of looking at this was saying, well, you have some sort of mechanical system. And Feynman looked at it as, let's say you have a trapdoor. And the trapdoor, you know, if you have a you know, fast molecule that's going, it'll go through the trapdoor, and then if it's a slower one, it won't. But the thing is, that generates a good amount of entropy just from, you know, you have some sort of ratchet system. So that in itself is problematic. So that's an example of some sort of mechanical system that isn't really, you know, wouldn't qualify as an intelligent being like Maxwell originally envisioned. So what people did later is they said, well, let's say that this daemon here actually is a computer. And as anybody knows about computers, if you have information in the computer, it has to be stored somewhere, say on a tape or in a hard drive or something like that. So what happens when this measurement is actually being made, you have this correlation between, let's see. It's either in the gas is either in, or the atom is either in one side of the cylinder or the other. And related to this is the proposition that this is a one, or this is a one. And from the perspective of someone on the outside, if you look at one of these things and make a measurement, then you know both of them, because you know this perfect correlation. So from this perspective, actually, if you are an observer observing a daemon and knowing that his information about the system is represented physically, then actually there's no decrease of entropy. Because what happens is if he goes through this whole cycle, you know, he starts out in a definite state. So the entropy of this with respect to the outsider is zero initially, and the entropy of this is logarithm, or would be one if you're measuring it in bits. But afterwards, after this whole cycle is done, this gas is back to being in an unknown state, and furthermore, the daemon's memory with respect to the outsider is in an unknown state. So although the outsider has gotten some measure of work out of this, the system is also increasing entropy with respect to him or her. So this is just interesting that, I don't know, someone can make a measurement and, you know, gain information and say, aha, with respect to me, this, you know, system's entropy has decreased. Or you can act on it and then, you know, say, oh, I've used my information, now it's really decreased. But with respect to someone on the outside who's looking at you, then, you know, you really haven't done much of anything. I guess that's about it. If anybody has any questions, please ask them, because I'd love to, I don't know, answer any questions about Bayesianism or anything like that. Anyone? Questions? No?
I just have a question for the top line there. When you say it must have a physical, okay, first for information, mm-hmm. like physical information, or just like say I just create two balls in my mind now, one green, one blue. Is that information or?
So there was an analysis of the Maxwell-Deemann problem that was done by Ehrman and Norton, who are two guys who write stuff, among them stuff related to Maxwell-Deemann. And they had, so the whole distinction between physical information and kind of subjective information is pretty tricky, because if you have some sort of measure of information, and this information is going to be a function of your probability of different outcomes. But the thing is that probabilities, as we stated earlier, are with respect to some sort of information that you already have. So in this sense, probabilities are, I don't know, somewhat subjective, in that someone could have different amounts of information and say, ah, the entropy of this system is, you know, this amount. And it's a very, very complicated question, because you can link thermodynamics and you can say, well, given these different macroscopic variable values, given that the pressure of the system is this, the temperature is this, the number of atoms is this, then there's actually a way of taking that and turning it directly into probabilities. And you can do that with, there's a method in Bayesian kind of literature called the maximum entropy method, which relates to kind of not physical information, if there is such a thing. And then you have this, I mean, going back to this, you have your, you know, kind of theoretical realm and your different probabilities. And you can say, well, based off of this, my, you know, the entropy of the system is this. And in general, you know, given different amounts of information about the system, you know, the entropy or the information is based off of your state of knowledge. So that can vary, but at the same time, there is kind of an operational way of defining entropy used in thermodynamics, which doesn't make any reference to probabilities. So. Yeah. So going back to whether that's physical information or kind of other information, it's a pretty murky question. And that's actually something I've been reading about and trying to see if there's people that have really coherent answers to this. And it's, I don't know, still somewhat of an open question.
Well, okay, so can we go to the next slide?
Next slide, yeah.
So, one more.
Oh.
One more. Yeah, one more.
It's the last one.
Yes, this
one. Okay.
So what is the link between like the first launch, and how can you conclude for the first point, the second point that an observer can observe?
So first of all, the way, I think there's two different ways I could answer this. The first one is that when Maxwell originally had this problem, he was saying, well, this is a daemon, and it is an intelligent being. And the thing was, he was kind of imagining, I don't know exactly what he was imagining, but this is kind of how I would imagine it. Well, you know, we have this thing called entropy, and it is related to, or it can be related to, our knowledge about the system. So if you put me in a box, say, and I was the daemon, then you could imagine someone just kind of looking at all these different molecules and assuming there's no inherent entropic cost to just making a measurement. which actually has been a construction by someone who gave an example of making a measurement that doesn't have any entropic costs. So make a measurement and then grab these different molecules and move them around. And based off of that, you can change the operational entropy with respect to someone outside the system. And they'll say, wow, this is amazing. The entropy of the system is decreasing, and I haven't done anything to the system. And isn't that amazing? But the thing is that when you're doing this, you're kind of assuming that you are outside of the system in some sense, and that you're not analyzing your own state. And you're just assuming, well, I know this, and that is that. But in reality, what that statement means is that if you're obtaining information about the system, if you're making measurements, then somewhere in your brain is a system that's analogous to this. And it's much, much more complicated, and that's a question for neuroscience and whatnot. But in theory, what that means is that given someone measuring some part of your brain there, then they can determine with 100% certainty which side of this box the molecule's in. And what that means is that, what that means in terms of information theory is just that these things are strongly correlated, or that the entropy of the system is the joint entropy. I haven't studied a lot of information theory, so I can't remember the exact terminology, but just that they're very strongly correlated. And this actually has been, Carlo Rovelli wrote this paper called The Relational Interpretation of Quantum Mechanics, which did something like this, but it was more an analysis of Wigner's friend, which is the same sort of thing, that if you have someone who is measuring a quantum system with respect to you, you measure it and the state collapses, then saying, well, let's say that every person, their state is in some sense physical, and you can step outside of that box and analyze, from another person's perspective, what exactly is going on. So I think just this general no statement that information is physical and any observer can in turn be observed is, leads to interesting analysis in different places.
Problem with this sort of idea that you can sort of unambiguously split your considerations into operational and theoretical things. So, for instance, I believe in Japan. I've never been there. But I think that's kind of like beyond question. That's probably true. But yeah, how do you split things up into those kinds of?
That's a very very good question.
And the other things, does that endanger
The thing is, my breaking up of that, this I don't think it's something that I said, but my breaking up of saying, well, this is the operational realm and this is the theoretical realm is not a definite line by any means. And I guess in a lot of senses, it's somewhat for convenience and somewhat for the whole idea that, you have to assume something if you want to get something. And the reason I chose it that way is just because things like I see this, I felt this, I heard this, whatever, are things that are, if you were to say, well, anything is beyond question, then kind of those are, in a sense, very kind of definite. Whereas something that you, are just reasoning about purely on the blackboard is something that, you could imagine some sort of experiment coming along and saying, well, actually, we've kind of disproved this concept or thrown this concept into question. Whereas it would be very hard to, read in a magazine, well, everything that you thought you had ever seen or felt, is not real.
So they do publish this stuff.
Oh, really? Well, I guess I don't read the same journals.
We just received
I got that. Yeah, was it the geocentric email?
Yeah.
Yeah. And it is very, very interesting because... So an example related to this is, astronomy. I was actually just talking with Luca about this just a bit ago. So astronomy, you have these things that are floating up in the sky. And you can make the statement that, well, these are all actually bodies, and they all have a definite position, and they all have definite momenta. And then use Newtonian mechanics to analyze the motion, whatever. And in that case, you know, that is a theoretical proposition because it's, you know, just something of theory. You could also say that, well, they're actually gods and they're flying around and stuff like that. And that would give you different predictions. So there's different theory that can be applied to this. But then say if you were somehow granted the ability to go in a rocket ship and fly all the way to Neptune, then all of a sudden Neptune is something that you're seeing and you are, I know, can circle around and say, well, actually, it is this definite body, and it's not a god because it doesn't look like a god or whatever. So the division is very, very murky. But I mean, the main reason was just pragmatic and saying, well, you know, we have to start with something that we can say, well, we are definitely sure that this is the case. And, you know, it was just chosen for convenience. Anyone else?
Can you scroll once back?
Just once?
I don't know how many, till the double slit part.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Here. So basically, you say the probability is not the average of the space of the conditional probabilities of omega 1 and omega 2.
Well, I should have put that in quotations because that's how the analysis is usually presented. But I mean, first of all, as I stated in the first slide, this is an illegal probability. You're not including the context in this. And it's just assumed that, well, you know, I mean, for people that, I don't know, will say that there is a context, you're just assuming that everyone knows what the context is.
So are you basically saying that, like in that blackboard, if you ever have a paradox or something like that, like in the case of double slit experiment, you always have some sort of a way to go from lowercase omegas to uppercase omegas to salvage your theory in that way? And if so, what is the physical, what do you really do to the omegas to get uppercase?
So I wouldn't put it so much as, sorry, the uppercase omegas and lowercase omegas, that was just a convention that I kind of introduced. But what you can do, and I don't know if anyone's published anything about this, but it's just very, very related to the idea that probability theory is a mathematical theory. It says nothing explicit about the real world. And what happens is if you introduce some sort of theoretical entity, it's always, always possible that you can get some sort of experimental outcome that will refute that and will throw that in a doubt. And the thing is that with probability theory, if you have some sort of, so if you're reasoning about, I don't know, we'll just say A1. This is abstract. This could be rain. This could be, I don't know, an experimental outcome. And you can say, well, my relevant context is, say, a few different things, X and Y. And if it's rain, you could say, well, the mean color of the clouds, and then the, I don't know, brightness or darkness of the sky or something like that. But if your kind of predictions based off of this model don't agree with what you're actually seeing, then you can say, well, actually, there's this different context. There's some element Z. And if that still doesn't work, you could keep expanding this. And kind of the logical conclusion of all of this is that you talk about propositions and you say, well, you know, I know that this thing, or I'm reasoning about something at a certain place and time. And you're saying, well, you know, the relevant context for this is that it's an event that happens at this place and at that time. So what that implies is that if you're saying, well, every different event has its own context, then you can't ever compare events and you can't make predictions. And this is kind of, I mean, it's almost as if you take out the theory entirely and you just say, well, we're just going to state events that happen, not make any predictions. So in a sense, I think what you're commenting on, this is always something you can do. You can always say, well, actually, there is this thing that distinguished between the two, so we can't compare. And that's very, that's, I mean, one of the fundamental reasons why probability theory is a mathematical theory and has no inherent predictive power. You have to introduce a theory if you want to get anything. Did that answer? Okay. Anyone else?
So you said that the axioms of probability theory should not be anyway connected to the real world.
Yes.
But in the case, you know, when you just add the probability saying that gives it to, is it kind of an axiom?
Well, so you add the probabilities. So let's say you have two different contexts. You have situation C and situation D. So if you're talking about, let's say that you want to say, well, it went through slit 1 or it went through slit 2. So this would be something like omega 1 or omega 2. And you can't say, I mean, you can't compare statements taken from different contexts. That's kind of, I don't know if that's an explicit rule in probability theory. I don't know, but it's something that just isn't allowed. So adding probabilities, it's always possible. So you could say, well, I mean, I know the frequency with which this happens, and I know the frequency with which this happens. My information is the same in both cases. So I can, you know, kind of add the probabilities for some sort of future event. But the thing is, it's always possible after that to say, well, actually, you know, this was taken from one context and this was taken from a different context because they happen in different places or different times. So this doesn't inherently say anything about the real world because you have to have this kind of context element which relates to the real world and says when you can actually compare things or not. But the axioms of probability theory, I don't know if I stated that or not, but in the Bayesian view, one axiom system is something called Cox's axioms, which take as their fundamental statements, one of the axioms, so they sound kind of vague, but they actually have clear definitions that I'm saying here. But it's consistency, that you can't reason about something using the rules of probability theory and arrive at two different probabilities given the same information. And the fact that probabilities are represented by real numbers and that probabilities don't violate your common sense. And that, in particular, is reduced to a few subpropositions, which eventually allow you to derive the additive and the negation rule for probability theory and such. Anyone else? Okay. Well, thank you all very much.